From Public Radio International, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The internet is cool again. The dot-com crash is 5 years in the past now, but this new era called Web 2.0 is not about bubbles or business models anyway. It's about the transformation of conversation. Who gets to talk and how? About what? Who's got authority? Who is judged to have authenticity? On this new web, the old static pages and commerce sites have become a living, breathing discourse. It can be hyper-local, one village at a time, but it's also global on many blogs and podcasts, and everywhere the talk is fast and free, with new user-friendly tricks that let you sort the new web by message tags. You can speed on your writing or your voice by syndication. Web 2.0 is changing the way we all communicate. And finally, the doomsday predictions about the old models of journalism, of marketing, of research are no longer exaggerated. Web 2.0 is next on Open Source. First, the news. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, the radio program that aims to think and link like the web, with an open source website where you will get used to the sound of human conversation on the internet. In this inaugural hour, we want to walk around the new landscape. We're calling it Web 2.0 with a few of the people who laid it out. In the studio with me, the blog philosopher David Weinberger, also the father of some of the new magic of syndication, Dave Weiner. On the line from Santa Barbara, California, Doc Searles, who I hope can translate this open source idea out of software speak into the way the rest of us live, Doc Searles. Please join the conversation by telephone at 877-673-6767 or sign in, post a comment, and ask a question at radioopensource.org. David Weinberger, you're the guy in that beautiful little book called Small Pieces Loosely Joined, who said that the web changes our understanding of everything, including time and space and community, maybe even truth. For example, please.
I think the fundamental question, at least that I think about frequently, is why is it that this is a weird medium, or actually, I think it's more like a world. But this web thing is just really, really odd. It's everything about it is at least slightly off, and a lot of it is way, way off of what we expect. And nevertheless, the adoption rate for this technology, for all its weirdness, has been phenomenal. It's been a curve that goes almost straight up, which is not the way it's supposed to be. When a technology is difficult or unfamiliar or weird, it should be hard to get people to adopt it, but people are running to it. And so I think you have to ask why, and I think that behind it, there is this sense of joy and liberation. Which only makes sense, and I think in some way it's actually revealing the depths of our background despair, the way that we've grown up, and we're so used to the context that we're in that we don't even notice how despairing it is. And in particular, the idea that for generations now, we've assumed a sort of a broadcast model in which people who have money or have authority or power, they get to speak to us, and we get to sit on the couch, face forward, and listen. And it's been basically passive, and some of it's been great, and some of it's been terrible, but we get to listen, they get to talk.
Papa Cronkite sits there and tells the family what went on in the world today.
Absolutely, and you know he was, for many of us, he was a really good filter. But nevertheless, he's a filter. It was being done for us, and when it comes to marketing, it was being done to us, which isn't so great. So now this new world, this new public space opens up, and we can fill it with whatever we want. And so we fill it with the stuff that we as human beings really, really care about, which is our voice. We get to speak, and we get to talk about the things that matter to us. We get to talk in our own voice, use the words we like,
but
the jokes we like.
But let me ask you, we've been saying for years on the internet, everybody can be a publisher, every listener can be a talker. When does it click in for ordinary people?
Well, it's clicked in already. In one sense, every time you see a cab that has a URL, www.something, you are aware that there's a world there that is full of information that if you're not online, you're not getting. But the key there, I think, is not to think of the internet and the web only as places where there's information. Information in many ways is secondary to what is so liberating and joyful about the web. Obviously, that's very important. We can
liberating and joyful, that's twice you said that. What are the social values of this new world?
I would point to two, although there's lots and lots you can point to. One is that we get to speak about the things that we care about in the way that we want to. And the second is, it's not just us speaking. It's not that we get to be op-ed writers instead of only a handful working for the New York Times or whatever. It's not that. It's that we get to speak with other people. We connect. We make connections with other people. We're talking with other people about the things that matter to us. And that is, what is a greater source of joy than connection for humans?
I mean, what is it? Define the joy. When do you feel it?
Have you felt it today? Absolutely. I feel the joy every time I write a weblog entry, particularly if it's in response to somebody else, which is sort of my daily journal. When I was away for Memorial Day weekend, and it was very poor internet conditions. It was sort of nice out, so that maybe wasn't so bad. But it was bad for the internet, for my access to the internet. And I felt isolated. I felt that I was cut off from a stream of conversation among people that I know and many that I don't, most of whom I've met through the internet. There's just streams of conversation about stuff that I care about that's been going on without me.
Might you be addicted?
Well, only in this way that I'm addicted to friendship or addicted to conversation. So, yeah, sure I am.
Good. You know? Doc Searles, are you there? Doc Searles is a writer, editor, blogger, a man of many media, including radio once upon a time, Doc, right?
It's a form of my distant past. My nickname, Doc, is a fossil remnant of an old radio identity that's not worth revisiting. It's just, there it is.
And then you got a beautiful voice for radio. Then you made this wonderful soft landing in the blogosphere.
I always thought I had a great face for radio.
You edit the Linux Journal, which is all about the Linux world of open source software. I wish you'd briefly define the software meaning of it and then translate it into humanist language. What is open source about for you?
Two things. First, a small correction. I'm senior editor at Linux Journal. There are other editors there, and including an editor-in-chief and a managing editor, of which I'm neither. I'm the oldest editor on staff. That's my joke about being the senior editor. It's interesting that open source is one of those things where, as so often happens with language, a term gets borrowed from something that's arcane and specific. I mean, if you're in the open source community, which I write for, the definition is almost legalistic. You can go to opensource.org and you'll find 50-some different software licenses that are based on a precise description of what open source is. In the meantime, it's been adopted, you know, by your show, for example, and countless other things. And that meaning, I think, is somewhat different, actually. It means anybody can participate. And the source, whatever it is not closed. In the software world, there have always been what we call silos, and I would distinguish that from what Dave Weiner, who'll be on, who's there, and I'm sure will be on shortly, I think very accurately described as independent software. There is an awful lot of really good stuff that's not open source. It's been created by small independent developers. That's equally important. And it's
hackable, which is to say open, improvable.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is, and David Weinberg and I wrote a modest website a few years ago called World of Ends that was based on one of the architectural facts about the internet, that it was designed as an end-to-end thing. It was a world of ends, it was called. And that's, if you go to worldofends.com, you'll find it there. And there's a sort of a verity. It's really an ideal that's behind open source that we abbreviated as NEA. For nobody owns it, everybody can use it, and anybody can improve it. And that's sort of an ideal in the same way as land of the free and home of the brave is. I mean, you can find particular ways to say that's not quite true in this case or that, but there's a sense about open source that anybody can participate, anybody can improve it. And to expand on what David said earlier about voice, it isn't just that you're communicating a piece of information or that you're standing in the public square and shouting something. It's that you can come up with an idea that others can expand upon improve.
Take it, Dave. Doc, from the heretic days when it was a sort of a violation of private property that you should diddle with, you know, Bill Gates's brilliant
well,
tool
here.
I
don't think that's ever been the case. I think that there's always been a class of software that is not private. But
the open stuff is now associated with this explosive growth in the last 5 years. I mean, everybody, including IBM, is into open source idea. To me, the question is, how do you take it out of that software industry and put it into the public square?
I don't think you take it
square.
Out of there. I think that we've simply borrowed an idea from it. You know, it's just a metaphor. It's sort of like, you know, we borrowed the passing lane and the fast lane and the cul-de-sac from driving, right? And we use it in all kinds of other places. The whole thing with open source is that anybody can participate. Anybody can improve what's already out there. It's not exclusive. It's not the province of the rich or the few or the privileged. It's something that anybody can participate in. I was thinking earlier of how many people I know in the blogosphere, for example, that have professions. I mean, there's one guy who's fairly well known. I'm not going to say who he is right now because I don't want anybody to be prejudiced about it, but his main job is working with junk auto parts. And he's got all kinds of cool stuff that he writes all the time that expands on things that other people have written or are original. And in the old days, he would have been confined to that profession.
One sec. I got to introduce Dave Weiner and acknowledge your huge hand, Dave Weiner, in inventing RSS, Real Simple Syndication. It's a technology with a social vision. And you're a social visionary, too. What is the picture we're working on here?
Well, I'm also a programmer, and listening to Doc talk about programming, I think that, Doc, we're gonna have to figure out what all these non-programmers mean by open source, because I've felt the same way that you felt it. Okay, I want to lecture these people and say, no, that's not what open source is. But there is a thread that connects all these things together. Blogging, you mentioned RSS, this new art called podcasting. We've come up with something called unconferences. The thing that they have in common is that they can't be thought of in terms of audience and superior thinker. The journalist in the past was basically somebody, you know, a journalist would interview 5-10 people, you know, and then would maybe talk to a market researcher and get some data, string together sound bites from each of these people to tell the story that the journalist wanted to tell. And basically the person who was the expert in the area, the person that they were quoting, would end up playing the role that the journalist wanted to play. And this is the revenge of all the sources, basically. In this world, we get to tell our story. And if you want to know what we think, you don't have to go through the intermediary anymore. And this is the common thread of everything we're doing here, is called disintermediation. It's a big word, these things do.
That's an important phrase, revenge of the all sources. The sources. And there's a certain anger, there's a certain
Absolutely.
Leveling impulse in the whole thing. Speak up, speak your mind. Follow the glimmer in your brain from the inside,
right,
as Ralph Waldo Emerson said. We're talking about Web 2.0 with Dave Weiner, David Weinberger, and Doc Searles. Join the conversation with us.
Be a source. Visit radioopensource.org. Send show ideas, stories, and sound. Be a part of the production. Radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about this new world, we're calling it Web 2.0, where every reader can be a writer, every listener talker can be a broadcaster. Dave Weiner, you're a proto-blogger at scriptingnews.com, but you're also tightly identified with RSS, Real Simple Syndication. What's it about?
I love the term proto-blogger. I'm going to put that on my business card right underneath bad influence. RSS is like automated web surfing. So if you're like going hunting around looking for new stuff, if you find yourself doing that a lot, what RSS can do for you is take that process and, like all things with computers, just automate it. Another analogy is think about the sushi belt restaurant, where you've got this, you know, it's a great idea. Basically, you have the chef keeps putting new things onto the sushi belt, and you're sitting there and you're going, oh, I think I'll have one of those. I think I'll have one of those, one of those. And that's what RSS, that's sort of the net effect for the user, is that you now have the information, the news or the ideas or the community coming to you, and you're sitting there in a very convenient way, just being able to say, okay, I think I want to look more deeply at that or at that. And so I find the sushi
every
belt
time that little bit of eel is available, send me one.
Well, or maybe I don't like eel, so, you know.
I like the sushi boat analogy.
Exactly.
The boat floats by.
Well, everybody likes to eat, Doc, right? I mean,
right.
Yeah.
Our phone is 877-673-6767. I want to know, beyond the technology, what kind of a world we're trying to construct here. What's the what are the social values?
Well, it's a big change going on right now. I mean, you know, I think about the 20th century. The great innovation of the 20th century was we were able to achieve this sort of mass monoculture where only the very best people were able to perform. You know, I want to be Chris Lydon now, okay? I want to be you. I want to be able to go find the things that I'm interested in and put that together into my personal radio show.
I've wanted to be Chris Lydon.
Well,
for a
I think
while,
you
too.
Actually get that one. So I think that if you know, we're still all of us in this room, and probably everybody listening to this show were born in the 20th century, and so we tend to think of, you know, you can only do something if you're the very best person at it. But we used to, when we were before this centralization, if you wanted to hear some music on a Saturday night, you would either have to make it yourself, or you'd have to go to a friend's house and they would create they would be creative for you. And so I think that what we have at a human level, the great thing about it, and the reason why you're going to be able to get so many great people on the show, Chris, is because we're enabling creativity again, the individual, it's the Emerson vision that you always talk about, is that the individual creativity is the central focus now, not the mass. We don't want the best. I'm not interested in Michael Jackson or Elvis Presley. I want to sing, and I have been singing, by the way.
And not alone.
No, not at all.
But the result is not simply the inversion of the broadcast model where now the former listeners get to talk and the broadcast, you know, it is, as you say, it's we're not aiming at massness. We're breaking ourselves up into way smaller groups. We're reclustering around things that matter to us, what's interesting to us, and we're being much, much more fluid. So
there's a very old-fashioned American ideology inside it of self-reliance, individualism, speak your own piece,
absolutely,
kind of town
absolutely
meeting.
And now it's enabled. I mean, we have the means, mm-hmm, and we're taking them, and we're sort of all climbing off the giant cruise boats and all of the other instruments that gathered us to take things on passively.
Would you, any one of you, fit this Web 2.0 that we're celebrating into the rest of the scene in our media, including the decline of network television, they say, the audiences, the rise of Fox broadcasting, the shrinking unto death of a lot of newspapers, this generally intensely visual musical culture we live in? How does this play?
I'd like to take a stab at that in a short one, which is that what we're doing is not a medium. It's too immediate for that. It's too unmediated for that. I was bristle a little bit when people call blogging or anything on the net a medium, because it's so easy to project mediation on it. It's something where it's so immediate. I just get an IM from somebody saying, I'll pay you $10 to mention my name on the show. That's how immediate.
I'll pay you $20 not to.
we can create a market for this right now. It's just that it's that immediate. It's not mediated. It's in many ways it's so orthogonal or just.
Is it about unmediating our public life?
It's the real thing. It's not. This is sort of what we talked about in Clutrain. There was this great industrial interruption that said we get things from the big guys, right? And we're not doing that anymore. It's like Emerson has been sleeping all this time and woke up and said, "Okay, that was a nightmare, and we're over that now."
They get from us.
There's a difference, though.
David Weinberger.
That, yes, it has elements of standing up the town hall meeting, but it also has elements of sitting down and having conversations with people. And the element of individuality and self-assertion is absolutely there. But if that's all that it were, it would be incredibly tedious. Instead, it's people, from my point of view, it's people connecting in ways that establish new social relationships. And in fact, so much of that happens that I totally agree with you, Doc, that it's dangerous to talk about the web as a medium, but it's more like a world, and it's a world in which weblogs, for example, use them as an example. They look from the outside like places where we get to stand up and say what we want, and we get to be Tom Friedman or whoever our favorite op-ed person is. But in fact, they're not a medium where we're transmitting information. They are much more like who we are on the web. They're much closer to a self on the web, a person.
Isn't it still mostly geeks? And I keep wondering, where are the better writers, the famous public advocates, the famous teachers, professors, theologians?
Well, but 7 million people are on LiveJournal, and very few of them fit into that category, but the web is making an enormous difference to their lives.
The phone is 877-673-6767. Garth is calling from Indiana. Welcome, Garth.
Hi, thanks. My point of view, my question here had to do with I was going to talk about information overload, and I guess I've also got a dispute. I like Doc a lot. Hi, Doc.
Who
I
doesn't?
Like your stuff. I do have a problem with when you talk about, I guess, the lack of this being a media, when you talk about it being unmediated, it certainly is true, and that's part of the problem I've got with the information overload aspect. I think it's so easy to find yourself reading fascinating stuff in people's blogs and following the links, and in no time at all, you spend hours learning interesting stuff, but it may not be on point with what you were trying to get accomplished.
And you haven't earned a dime in all that time.
But the question is, that a problem, really? Getting over-informed, is that a problem?
It's not a problem, but I think there is a... I like having choices, and I like the fact that blogging gives me lots and lots of people's points of view that I can pick and choose. The problem is that I find so many fascinating ones that I want to follow, and I'm...
Well, you need to take control of your life. It's time to assert your personality here and stop being driven by other people.
Well, actually, I would say exactly the opposite, Dave.
It's to give up control completely.
Well, you know, everybody on the web has that problem to some degree or another. There's way too much good stuff to read. And so we keep inventing new ways of keeping ourselves, of finding what's interesting. Email for many of us is a recommendation engine. Every day people are writing and saying, you got to see this, you got to see that. Weblogs started out as a way of saying, here's where I've been, here's what I liked, here's what I don't. And you read Doc gives you a zillion pointers every day. Dave gives you a zillion pointers every day to the places that they've found interesting. And by the way, the interesting thing to me is that you go to the New York Times, for example, or any of the media, and you look at that page, and it has as many links as on Doc's site or Dave's site or my site, but they're all pointing back into the New York Times. Not one of them is pointing out except for the ads.
And that's unethical, right, David? I mean,
It's
an indication of a limited vision.
Mostly it's weird. It's like talking up your own sleeve.
Yeah.
You know,
and then the media accuses weblogs of being an echo chamber.
But right? We hear that concern all the time, Chris. I mean,
but your line from the beginning was that there's a generous impulse built into this technology. Share it. Give credit. Make a link. You're right. A great linker, Dave Weiner.
Yeah. Well, because I have a passion for points of view, for information, for discourse. I have the passion for news that a lot of reporters and journalists had when they started, but somehow had that kicked out of them as they learned to dumb it down. You know, they learned how to sell inside their own organizations. You know, that's why in the early days of the web, which is, by the way, what we're talking about anyway, it's the same basic principles. You had so many reporters that were so incredibly excited about it. And like you have today with radio people being excited about podcasting. It's the same thing that drove people, the same idealism that drove them to become, because they had a passion for information, for news. The thing is that we expect so much more today. I mean, if you think about it, 10 years ago, what you expected in the way of information, let's say you were going to Chicago or London or something like that, you know, might find out what the weather had been yesterday, the day before. Today, you want to know everything about what's going on there, and you expect to find it. And
we're blogging all this, of course, at the same time we're broadcasting it at radioopensource.org. Brendan Greeley is hang on, Doc. Brendan Greeley is on top of it. What are you hearing, Brendan?
Well, I'm IMing with a couple of people, and there's a debate raging right now about the website Live Journal, and the debate seems to center around whether or not a million teenagers writing about their love problems is irrelevant crap.
To whom?
Yeah, that's clearly
that
it's
highly
not
relevant. I would think
it's a Live Journal is the demographics happen to be. 13 to 18 primarily, that's where the curve is. It's primarily, but not only, of course, women and girls. And it's a social, it's a place where people get together. So who gives anyone else the right to say that the conversation that you're having with your friends that isn't appealing to them is crap? I mean, that's, you know, seems to me to be an uncalled for remark, very much an outsider's remark, an outsider from Live Journal and from the from those conversations.
Brendan, go fishing again. I want to knock the web in one detail, or at least raise a question, and then I also want to grant it some credit. But the knock is that the bloggers run together. There's a kind of mob rule, whether it's left bloggers bringing down Trent Lott or right bloggers bringing down Dan Rather. There's a piranha tendency. Beware bloggers when they get together.
I disagree with that totally. I think those are the things. Those are red herrings. I think that they're big, obvious red herrings. But it's too easy to project our usual prejudices on those because something big happened to the big media. I've seen so many more cases where if somebody's being treated unfairly or doesn't hear something right, they get corrected. The corrective nature of what goes on there is so much larger than any kind of ganging up.
And can I test a nice thought about the web, which is simply that I see a rising an authenticity standard in communication. Authority is down. Accuracy isn't prized the way standard media says it is, but authenticity is up. You hear something of the soul of writers on that web as you don't in the New York Times.
Yeah, and I think what this is exposing is a fault line that was already in the society, where we have one official view of what knowledge is that we've maintained through the academy, various forms of institutions, for thousands of years, that actually has little to do with what people have always, how people have always learned what sources to trust, what ideas to trust. In fact, the original idea of knowledge, which came to us, as you well know, directly from the Greeks, was one where it was intensely practical. It was how to decide who among all the speakers on political issues you can trust. Now, that's not mathematical knowledge, but that's where it started. It was embedded in a real human context with real human needs, like who we're going to go to war with or what crops we're going to. We're now at the point where the web is recalling that original notion of what knowledge is. And it's always been with us. I decide to trust the person I just met at a conference or on the train very quickly based upon the totality of the person, the person's voice.
Yes.
So the idea that knowledge has to be abstracted from voice, it has to be statements independent of who speaks it, that has developed into an ideal that nobody has fully believed outside of very specialized disciplines.
Speaking of other voices, the phone's 877-673-6767. Catherine is calling from Cambridge.
Christopher, first I welcome you back. I've missed you, and a lot of people have missed you, so it's nice to hear your voice again.
Catherine, thank
Amen.
You.
Amen.
Here.
Amen.
It is.
And it's also nice for you to let people talk and give them time to talk, which I find other moderators don't do. That said, and I don't mean to upset anyone listening, this is just my opinion. I'm a woman, a middle-aged woman. I do have a computer. I appreciate very much the side of it that would be equivalent to going to a library, accessible knowledge at the push of a button. That is absolutely wonderful. That said, what I don't like about it personally is that you keep saying that it fosters communication between people. It does, but I find that it does in a sort of a sterile way. I miss looking at someone when I have an exchange with them. I miss that very much on the net. And another thing I'd like to point out is it was said that this is going to make a lot of people globally more able to talk to each other. Let's not forget the affordability of it all. We're in the United States, and people can afford this technology, but there's a lot of people in third world countries that I personally would like to talk to, and that I don't believe can actually afford the technology yet.
Catherine, point taken. I nonetheless think it's a democratic medium, and the price comes down faster on this than on almost anything we've ever known.
What do you have to compare it to? I mean, TV doesn't allow you to have... I mean, I had this experience listening to Pledge Drive on another public radio station, and this thought formed in my head. What is my role in this? And, you know, it's basically to listen and to pay. And, okay, so now we've got a third thing that we can do, and we've, you know, think about it not... I mean, of course, it's great to... It's better even to talk with people face-to-face, right? It's got a higher fidelity to it. But think about what this is replacing. It's replacing a medium where your ideas were not welcome. You know, your money was welcome, your attention, your eyeballs were welcome, but your opinions and your ideas, your information were not.
Can I just say the joy of radio is, Catherine, that you don't have to see me and I don't have to see you. There's so much freight carried in your voice. So much concern, interest, curiosity, femininity, an accent I haven't placed yet entirely, but I love the individuality of people on just plain radio, including the call-in. Catherine, thank you. Have we warmed it up enough? I mean, speak to Catherine's point that there's a human dimension to be prized and cultivated and developed yet here. We just barely begun.
Can I jump in there?
Do it.
Two things. One is that I think it's very easy two nanoseconds after the Big Bang to complain about a lack of galaxies and planets and the rest of it. I think that's sort of where we are. That's the first thing. The second thing is I'd like to point out how easy it is to start something new that really is human. And I'm thinking in particular right now of what Dave Weiner did with what we're now calling the unconference. I mean, what I love about those kind of conferences, about any conference actually, but now about the unconference, is that you do get a chance at as low a cost as you possibly can get for people to get to meet in real time, in a real place. So that's sort of a handoff.
You can do it here too, either on our blog, which is radioopensource.org, radioopensource, one word, .org, or give us a call at 877-673-6767. This is a new radio show, Open Source, on its first night.
Raison d'etre.
Schadenfreude.
Watermelon.
Next picture we see Dick Tracy. He's been a detective so long, and he still has that slender form. Lou Valentine, why do our detectives get fat, I wonder?
Hello. Hello. How are you? I got an appointment with Dr. Wong at 10 o'clock tomorrow. You're going to get the needle for the spears. The needles are too small for me. He says the gorilla body needs spears.
That is a sample of sounds from the web, including, in order, a 1930s typewriting dirge.